thank you so much for being here. Appreciate seeing some folks in the room who care about this issue. For those of you who don't know me, although I think I pretty much know everyone, my name is Shane Ellison. I teach at Duke Law School in the Immigrant Rights Clinic, and so delighted to be with you this morning to talk about some important issues related to our immigrant refugees and neighbors, immigrants and refugees who are our neighbors and who are very much frightened during these times and in need of our assistance. So in terms of like an agenda, I was thinking what I would do is first just go over some of the big changes that we've been seeing recently in the last few months since the inauguration, give you a bit of a big picture overview of some of those changes, as well as to kind of focus in on maybe a couple of them to help you understand sort of the impact, and then transition to thinking about ways in which you can help and serve. And I definitely invite your questions, either throughout or at the end. Hopefully it'll be a discussion. So that is my plan. So we'll go ahead and begin. And as a, sort of an initial matter of framing, you know, this is a verse that's really important to me as a follower of Jesus. This is something that is not just a job, it's a calling from my perspective. And so when I think about welcoming immigrants, you know, I very much think about it in this context, the Matthew 25 context, right? So Jesus so closely identifies with immigrants that he says how we treat them is sort of a measure of how we treat him, right? And so if we welcome Jesus by welcoming the immigrant, that's an sort of indicia, right, of a follower of Jesus. And conversely, if we are behaving in ways that are not welcoming, that also says something. And so just wanted to begin with that sort of normative framing before talking about the actual nuts and bolts of some of the policies that are at play here. So, okay, so this will be a bit of a whirlwind. So since January 20th, there have been 221 changes according to the Immigration Policy Tracker. This is a database that's maintained by a professor at Yale and Stanford, and he tracked all the changes during Trump 1.0 and has been tracking all the changes in Trump 2.0. And so that 221 changes is just since January 20th, right, just since the inauguration. Now, we'd be here all morning if I talked about all 221 of them. And so instead, what I'm going to do is try to focus on some of the high-level ones that I think are of relevance here. So, and I'll go fairly quickly, but I will try to pause for sort of specific descriptions of some of these things. So the first thing is all asylum at the southern border has essentially been entirely frozen, right? There really isn't any more asylum at the southern border. That is, at least in my legal opinion, contrary to U.S. and international law. But that's sort of where we're at right now. The other thing that the president has ordered is the return of the Migration Protection Protocols Program, sometimes called Remain in Mexico or MPP. So that was a program that during the first Trump administration sent 70,000 people into sort of tents and shelters and things along the border to await for an asylum hearing. And it was a program that had a lot of negative effects on immigrants seeking asylum at the border. Human Rights First has found that thousands of people were subject to violence while they were waiting on the border. There were kidnappings, rape, some people were killed. So a lot of violence happened to migrants in the MPP program while they were waiting last time. And so it hasn't started back up yet, but there's been an announcement that it will start back up. Access to counsel in MPP was also really low, and so grant rates were exceptionally low. I think that we're like in the 1% range of people. So it was a program that was very much by design meant to limit access to asylum even when it existed. And that's sort of our best case scenario right now, right? Asylum just doesn't exist. So MPP might be the only way in which people could seek asylum in the future, and they don't even have that right now. There's also an indefinite sort of pause to refugee resettlement, or that's what was ordered. The immediate consequences of that when the order was issued is that there were 10,400 refugees who had been approved for travel to the United States who suddenly found their entry barred, their travel plans canceled. 1,600 Afghans were also among that group that were ready to come to the United States, and they had their travel plans canceled as well. Stephen Miller, who was a senior policy advisor with the Trump administration the first time and is again a senior advisor to the administration this time, said fairly candidly last time that he would be happy if not a single refugee ever stepped foot again in the United States. So these policies will sometimes be discussed in terms of needing additional security vetting or other sort of policy justifications, but I think there's pretty good evidence that the real motivation for these programs is just antipathy. There's a lot of antipathy towards people who are protected in the programs, and so really concerted effort to wind them down, freeze them, stop them. Now, many of these things are being challenged in court, and we don't have time to necessarily go into all of those details, but there has been some promising litigation on the refugee front. But whether or not that continues sort of remains to be seen. There was a court injunction against the administration on the refugee pause, and then the administration pulled contracts with resettlement organizations, making it sort of impractical to continue to do it, even if it is sort of legally required. So there's a lot of fighting and back and forth going on right now on that. Next thing is green card applications for refugees and asylees. Those are all paused right now as well. So these are people who are already brought into the United States as refugees or who are already granted asylum inside the United States, which, by the way, asylum is just getting the classification of a refugee once you're already here. All of their applications for permanent resident status are on hold right now. We don't really know the reason. There was an ostensible reference to just fraud or abuse in the system, and there's need for additional vetting. But as of right now, those folks aren't able to get their green cards because of that pause. On kind of the enforcement side of things, there is increased use of the military for detention, deportation efforts, and border enforcement. The administration has begun using the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, which is a military detention facility to hold immigrants for a period of time before moving them out. There's been really interesting litigation on that. The pattern that we're sort of observing is that as soon as we sort of get close to maybe a victory on trying to protect people at Guantanamo Bay, they get shipped out to a new place. So there's a very much of a like a whack-a-mole kind of phenomenon right now where litigators are trying to challenge these moves and people are then being shuffled off to other places to avoid those court orders. Another big one is the termination of the humanitarian parole program. That impacts more than 500,000 people who lawfully entered the United States. And I'm just going to put an asterisk on that because that's one of the things I'm going to come back to and focus on a little more detail in a few more slides. TPS is another big one. So there's about 500,000 Venezuelan people who are at risk of having their TPS terminated. The first wave of Venezuelan TPS holders was a group of about 350,000 people. They were slated to have all of their TPS terminated tomorrow. There was a court order that put that on pause, so that's sort of some good news. But the effort to take away temporary protected status is another. Thank you. No problem. Is another big move, another big change that we're seeing, and I'm going to come back to that in a second as well. And for those of you who don't know, temporary protected status is a form of protection for people who are fleeing like a conflict zone, certain natural disasters, other kinds of big catastrophes that might happen in the home country that would make deporting a person back to that country sort of unsafe or inhumane. And so the Trump administration did announce in the executive orders that they sort of intend to take away TPS for everyone. So far, it's Venezuela and Haiti is what we've seen, but I think anyone who has TPS is potentially at risk right now. The other thing that they've done is anyone who was in the humanitarian parole program to come into the United States, all of their benefit applications are frozen right now. So if they had applied for a work permit, for example, we're being told that that's not going to be processed until additional, again, vetting for security or fraud or whatever is concluded. There are other people who came in through the parole program who maybe have the ability to seek a green card, for instance. Those applications are also frozen in this moment. The other change, and this one's a little more technical and difficult to explain, but the administration wants to use expedited removal at a very, very high level. So this is a legal procedure for deporting people rapidly outside of the context of deportation proceedings. In the immigration court system right now, the backlog, I think, is more than 3 million people. And so what that means as a practical matter is if you want to deport a lot of people and do it lawfully through the deportation sort of system, the immigration courts that were set up to handle it, it's going to take a really long time because there just aren't enough judges to process all of those cases. So what we're seeing is the administration is doing many things to try to get out of that slow deportation process to be able to use fast deportation processes, and expedited removal is one of those. People who entered on various humanitarian parole programs are also at risk of expedited removal. That's one of the categories of people who could, in theory, be subject to that, and so there is an intentional announcement to use that very broadly. Another huge and significant change, quite concerning, is the president's ordering of federal agencies to stop adhering to the 14th Amendment's birthright citizenship clause, right? So everyone born in the United States, regardless of the immigration status of their parent, with just a few small exceptions, is a U.S. citizen. And that's been the law since the 14th Amendment was passed in the 1800s, and the specific legal question of whether the immigration status of your parent impacts your status when you're born here was answered in 1898 in a case called Wong Kim Ark. So this is a long-settled legal question, very concerning for a president to essentially tell federal agencies to violate the 14th Amendment. I think three federal courts have also found this to be blatantly unconstitutional, have enjoined the president from doing so, but the administration continues to vigorously defend this policy, so it's another thing that must be contended with now. I'm still on this slide. We're still going through our 221, although we're not all the way through the list of highlights yet. Another very concerning move is employing the Alien Enemies Act, which is a late 1700 era law that allows for the president to rapidly remove people who are declared enemies of the country. So the original intent of this law would be like if there were an invading army, for example, that were coming into the United States, you wouldn't have to sort of go through a process of deportation. Now, to be clear, there was no process of deporting people in the 1700s. That didn't get created until much, much later. But the idea of these two laws sort of existing side by side is if you have an invading army, you should be able to repel them and not sort of go through a process of deporting foreign nationals from the United States. That's the point of the law. To be clear, we're not being invaded right now, but the president is using this law in order, again, to try to circumvent that backlog in immigration courts that I mentioned earlier. If he does it through the normal process, it's going to take too long. So there are many efforts to kind of get around that, and so Venezuelans in particular have been targeted through this Alien Enemies Act. So about 300 people have been rendered to El Salvador as a result of use of this law. Specifically, they've gone to a Salvadoran prison called SECOT, which is the Terrorism Confinement Center. It's a prison that has documented human rights abuses. There's forced labor that takes place there as well. And so we're extraordinarily concerned about the people who've been deported there. The ostensible justification was within Venezuelan community is this fear that there are members of this Tren de Aragua, a criminal organization, and so that's the argument that this is an invading army. But in reality, we know that a number of people who've been swept up in this process are not gang members. Many of them are being designated as gang members simply because of their tattoos. Some of those tattoos include a Real Madrid tattoo. Another tattoo was an autism awareness tattoo. So not gang tattoos, just tattoos sort of generally is being used. And at least one of the men who was deported there was a Salvadoran man, not not Venezuelan. It was contrary to a court order that had said he should be protected from deportation to El Salvador. And so this is actively being litigated right now. But that would have been one of the one areas that, you know, sort of 2 weeks ago, if you had asked me, well, is anyone sort of protected from some of these moves, I would have said someone who's granted withholding of removal has rock solid protection to not be deported to the country where they were granted that protection to. And so that is even at risk right now. We're also seeing folks who are lawful permanent residents who are being targeted. That would have been another category that I said, well, if you have lawful permanent residents, then surely you are protected from some of these moves. But what we've seen is specifically in the gentleman who led some of the protests at Columbia University, he is a lawful permanent resident, and he was targeted for an enforcement operation. He's currently being detained in Louisiana as he litigates his case, but he was targeted simply for expressing views that the administration didn't approve of. Mahmoud Khalil is his name. That's the sign to the right there. Top right is the photo. And then beneath that is a woman from Turkey, Rumeysa Aztürk. And her offense, she was on a student visa. She's on the bottom right there. Her offense was contributing to an op-ed that was critical of some of the U.S. policies towards Palestinians. Just to continue with the slide, the picture in the middle is a picture of the Sikot prison that I mentioned in El Salvador. And so you see men there. On the left, it's a little hard to make out, but left bottom is a soldier at the U.S. border with the fence and the barbed wire and things, and so just meant representing increased use of the military in border enforcement. Top left is the policy tracker that I mentioned, so you can count these changes daily if you wish by going to the immigration policy tracker and seeing what new changes are there. The last thing I'll say on this slide before I move on, because I'm probably over time already, is it's not just members of the immigrant community that have been targeted by some changes. A couple of other things I would flag is, obviously, we know about the funding cuts to service organizations. This has impacted a lot of my colleagues. I have a lot of friends and colleagues who work at nonprofits who've been laid off, as we well know. It's impacted our own community as well. There was a stop work order for people specifically working with unaccompanied immigrant children. So that was another change. Again, I think litigation is ongoing there. Targeted funding cuts to nonprofits providing more physical aid and shelter, food, that sort of thing along the border. And I think one of the most concerning things about that change is the administration has asserted that people who are engaged in providing shelter to migrants are facilitating unlawful immigration, are facilitating the harboring of non-citizens, and that's significant because that's a criminal violation. So they're essentially making the argument that people that are engaged in providing aid to non-citizens are harboring, and the penalty for harboring can be 5 years in prison, right? So the notion that people that are engaged in serving immigrants are violating the laws is a deeply concerning development. Immigration lawyers were named in particular in an executive order that came out 2 weeks ago. It seems like a long time ago, but I think it was 2 weeks ago. And they specifically name asylum lawyers as well, which is actually my specialty as an asylum lawyer, saying that we engage in fraud, we engage in coaching of our clients, and that we should be sanctioned, we should be investigated, we should, in theory, be prosecuted. And so very, very concerning at this moment if you're an immigrant rights defender, if you're a lawyer that's engaged in litigation challenging some of these policies, the administration has very clearly said they intend to go after us in that context as well. So there's a lot of widespread fear, as you can imagine, within the immigrant community. Again, glad that you're here to be thinking with me about some of these changes. So now what I want to do is I want to zoom in a little bit, right? So I think I went through 30-some-odd changes, just a sampling of the 221, okay? So now I want to give you some context on just a couple of the big ones. I said I'd come back to humanitarian parole and temporary protected status. So first, humanitarian parole. What is humanitarian parole? Well, it's a form of benefit that exists in the Immigration and Nationality Act. It's in INA 212D5A, if you want to take a look at it. But the president has the authority, and the Attorney General and Secretary of Homeland Security have the authority to grant parole, which is not what you're probably used to hearing parole. Often we think of parole as someone's in jail or detention and they're let out. In the immigration context, parole is a legal form of authorization to enter the United States and to be here for a temporary period of time. So humanitarian parole is using that authority for a humanitarian reason, right? And so during the last administration, there were a couple of humanitarian parole programs that were implemented. They're all on the chopping block. So the first one to mention, I guess, would be the Cuban, Haitian, Venezuelan, and Nicaraguan humanitarian parole program. And it's sometimes, you'll see it in the news, sometimes abbreviated by those four sort of initials, the CHNV program. And so the idea of this program was to provide a lawful pathway to people fleeing violence in those four countries to come to the United States and then apply for protection. The journey to the United States is very dangerous. The administration didn't want a large queue of people at the southern border, and so by creating this program, it was a way to allow people to come into the United States, apply for protection, and not go through a dangerous journey up to the southern border, as is otherwise sort of required if you're going to try to apply for asylum, but you have no way of coming to the United States. So that's one program in terms of use of humanitarian parole, and I've got the little green dots there to kind of indicate those four countries that were covered by that CHNV program. The other sort of red dot indirectly impacted is over Mexico, and the reason why I did that is because the other huge humanitarian parole program that was used by the Biden administration was use of what's called the CBP-1 application. It was an application that was created that people could download on their phone so that if they weren't covered by, let's say, one of these other country-specific humanitarian parole programs, and they wanted to come to the United States to apply for asylum, once they reached the border, they could download an application. It was a sort of geo-targeted application, so you could only use it if you were physically located near the border. You download the application, and then you apply for an appointment. And the idea was that there would be an orderly way in which people could ask for asylum at the border by using this this appointment system. The demand, by the way, for both these programs far exceeded the amount of visas or CBP-1 appointments that were available, but a lot of people did benefit during that four-year period through this CBP-1 program. And so one of the early executive orders issued by the Trump administration was to terminate both of those programs. And we've already seen the CHNV program. Notice has gone out to everyone who used that program to say that their parole is being terminated. I think it's effective later this month in April, as well as the work authorization. And I want to spend just a moment of time talking about that process as well. So in order to apply for humanitarian parole, you needed to fill out a form, you needed to pay a fee. I think the fee is $575. It's an additional $500 for work authorization. And you had to get a background check. You also had to have a sponsor in the United States apply for you in order to get this program. So people filled out forms. They used a government program. They came into the United States, I'm going to say, quote unquote, the right way, right? And now they're here with the thought that they could be here until the end of that parole period. And the United States is now terminating that program and terminating it prematurely for a number of people. So I'm going to just hang an asterisk on that and come back to that concept in just a second, because I think that's significant. The CBP-1 program didn't have a fee, but it did require a process. It did require someone downloading the app, waiting for an appointment to become available, and sort of pursuing that, that program. As for TPS, very similar. The TPS program, and I'm going to talk about that more in a second. The TPS countries impacted, as I said, are Venezuela and Haiti, so overlapping with the parole programs. The two blue dots, which I have not talked about, are Ukraine and Afghanistan. And I'm putting those at risk. There hasn't been an announcement yet that parole will be terminated for nationals of those countries, but the executive order indicated a desire to terminate all categorical parole programs, which we take to mean probably those two countries as well. So we don't have news of that yet, but there's reason to think that it may be coming soon. So the next slide here is just to give you a bit of a sense of the numbers here. So it is possible to read that. Excellent. So on the right, I've just pulled a screenshot of a Migration Policy Institute graphic that was created to give you a sense of the numbers of people who have various forms of status in the United States. These are rough estimates, but they are accurate. So on the Haitian TPS side, you can see it's about 200,000. On the Venezuelan TPS side, it's almost 600,000. I've seen some reports say that it may be over 600,000. Very, very large group of people. The first wave of people impacted by the one that was going to expire tomorrow was like 350. So the remainder, I think, had TPS until later this year, also on the chopping block for getting terminated. The CHNV program is about 530,000 people. And the CBP-1 program, that parole program, was over 900,000, 940,000 people with parole. And so that's a lot of folks covered by that parole program. When I was sort of doing the math for this, and I was also trying to add in some of the potential future parole programs that could be, TPS programs that could be cut, the figure could be as high as 3 million people in the United States with some form of status, parole, temporary protection, work authorization that could be at risk for having this taken away, right? So this is just, again, zooming in a little bit on a couple of programs that are impacting millions of people. Millions of people who went through a legal process, who paid a fee, who waited in line, so to speak, who did what they were supposed to do, and are now having that program taken away, and having their status taken away. And so I want to just take us back a moment to what I said earlier about the deportation process, right? It's a very onerous process. The backlog is really significant. It's very hard to remove large numbers of people if you're going to go through that process. And so what I think we're looking at here is not an effort to go after people who are undocumented. Sure, that is one of the priorities. But it's dwarfed in comparison to going after people who actually have legal status, okay? So to kind of make that point is the next slide. So on the right, you see an image of the numbers of deportations per day, I believe is what it is, daily average. People who were deported. And this is going back into the Biden administration and taking it up into the Trump administration. I think the data only goes, January is the last marking there. I think it might include February and March's data as well. But what you see is that the number of daily deportations are roughly on par with what they were under the Biden administration. Okay, so these are the number of people who would be without status, without protection in the United States, and are subject to deportation. That number is relatively flat, and that may be surprising that I'm sort of pointing that out. But the reason why I'm pointing that out is because if you do the math on the numbers here of the people who are impacted by deportation policies for people who are amenable to deportation, that is people who don't have lawful status, you'll see that this figure averages out to about 220,000 people or so in the course of this year, right? So now contrast that figure, about 220,000 people who are without status who can be deported lawfully using the immigration deportation system, with the figure earlier that we talked about. More than 3 million people with status who are having it taken away. So I'm intentionally drawing your attention to this contrast to really show that the administration will sometimes talk about an effort to enforce immigration laws against people who don't have protection, who are deportable, and who they wish to remove. But the data shows that that's actually not the top priority, 200,000 versus more than 3 million. right? The emphasis here is to go after people with status to try to take it away. Take it away to make it easier to hit those mass deportation numbers. If they're just using the normal processes and just using the law and enforcing it against people who are actually without status, they won't hit these mass deportation numbers. In order to hit the mass deportation numbers, they have to actively take away people's status that's valid already. And try to use other techniques for circumventing normal processes of due process and removal proceedings in order to hit these large numbers. So I think that's significant, you know, for a couple of reasons. But one is, I think it very specifically undermines the claim that this is just about enforcing immigration law, okay? So nothing about taking away TPS or parole is legally required. In fact, if you think about what it means to have temporary protected status, the country must be undergoing some kind of significant turmoil in the country to get TPS. If we take Venezuelan TPS, which is probably the best example of a country getting TPS for really good reasons, let's just go into that very, very briefly. So the Nicolas Maduro regime is a regime, very brutal, a dictatorial regime that's in control of Venezuela right now. And there are about 7.7 million Venezuelans living outside of Venezuela, right, that have fled the country due to violence, due to conflict. Not all of them have come to the United States. In fact, more of them have gone to Colombia than have gone to the United States. But they're also throughout South America, Central America, all seeking protection in various places. They have very good reason to flee. Nothing about that situation has improved. Nothing about that situation has gotten better since the inauguration. It's just as bad as it was a few years ago when TPS was first designated for Venezuela. So we're taking it away not because it's legally required. It's arguably not even legally justified, right? The administration is taking it away because it facilitates a larger goal of mass removals irrespective of what the law says. So not only is it not required to take away TPS, it's probably legally suspect to take away TPS, especially if we're talking about Venezuela. And in fact, a court did enjoin the administration from ending TPS, as I mentioned, I believe earlier, because it's legally suspect. There's arguably not proper process being followed, and there's evidence that what's really driving this, and this is what the court found, so what's really driving this is racial animus, rather than actual legal justifications, okay? Same thing could be said for humanitarian parole. There's not really a good reason to take it away. An administration does have the discretionary legal authority to wind TPS down or sort of discontinue it, but to take it away would signal something has kind of changed about the situation, and things really have not changed about these situations that would justify these legal moves. There are larger policy considerations that are going on here that are driving some of these decisions. So I'll shift gears now and think a little bit more with you about sort of how we can be involved and how we can help. And we're a small enough group, hopefully there are ideas that you have and questions that you wanna ask about what we've talked about so we can sort of spend a lot of the time that we have left together on that. You know, I think the first thing is, and I have to give a shout out to Laurel for this. I actually asked Laurel last week because she had done such a wonderful job at talking about her own border trip experience. And Laurel, if you don't know, is very, very engaged in the community, engaged in advocacy, specifically locally. And so I wanted to get ideas from her as well. But one of the things that she told me is, you know, just getting to know your immigrant neighbors, learning their stories, so you can better understand the issues is a practical thing that you can do, and I love that idea. I think that's a really, really great idea. I also think it's a practical way in which we can show hospitality for our immigrant neighbors, just getting to know them, right? And so I wanted to lift up and elevate that suggestion as well. I think also speaking out for our immigrant neighbors is really important. There's a lot of false narratives going on. I've tried to highlight just a couple of those for you this morning. There are many, many more that we can talk about, and maybe through your questions, I'd be happy to think more about some of those false narratives with you. But just speaking out in support of the immigrant community, I think matters. I think it helps. Whether you do that through social media, right, or just talking to people or other forms of engagement, letting people know that they are welcome, both through sort of direct engagement as well as speaking out in other ways, I think is really important. I think that matters. The other way you can speak out is contacting your representatives, right? Just communicating the displeasure, if you experience displeasure at these sort of announcements, with your elected officials and letting them know that this is not something that you approve of, that this is not something that's acceptable to you, and expressing that, I think, is really valuable as well. Local groups have been very significantly hit by many of these funding cuts, by the stop work orders, by the changes that we're seeing. As I mentioned earlier, many of my colleagues in sort of local nonprofits, I know Church World Service and World Relief, both have been impacted by these changes. There's some struggling going on, right? And so I think if you are in a position to where you can support them financially, I think that they would absolutely welcome that. Thinking as well about volunteer opportunities, good neighbor teams, just a shout out for my wife, Jenny, who's doing some organizing there, would be one way to kind of get involved. La Siembra is something that Laurel mentioned as well, another local immigrant rights organization that does trainings. If you're interested in volunteering with them, there are a variety of different programs that they have going on. That would be another way to get involved and to support support a local organization doing some really good work. The other thing to mention is just if you encounter people in the community who need resources, I put a QR code up for you, and I can leave this up as well. But you can use this to get to a website that we maintain at the Immigrant Rights Clinic. We've posted some resources there, sort of general Know Your Rights information, information about some of the new changes that members of the immigrant community need to know about. I actually skipped over one of the changes I meant to talk about, which is a universal registration program. That's big, that's scary for the immigrant community. Understanding how they can comply with that is kind of complicated. So we try to break down some of those considerations in our resources. There are a number of other things that we put in those resources, but feel free to share those out. If you know people in the community who have questions, they want to know what their rights are, they want to know what their responsibility and obligations are, they want to know how to safety plan, right? There are a lot of good resources there as well. And we have one resource in English and another resource in Spanish that was prepared by the North Carolina Justice Center, the ACLU, and some other great local organizations that's very much targeted for North Carolina in terms of providing assistance. And, you know, I think, like, as a sort of final thought here, and I did intentionally want to save time for questions and to hear from you, you know, some of these things may seem small, but I was really struck last Sunday when Chris was talking about just small sort of offering of loaves and fish, right, can be used by our God to do big things. And I think that this problem feels really big. You know, it feels like more than 5,000 people, right? It feels like millions of people. And our efforts feel really small, smaller than perhaps two fish and five loaves. But I think that if we are offering what we can and trusting that God will use that, I do think that a difference can be made. And so, yeah, that's sort of my concluding thought. And definitely welcome questions from you. We have, I think, at least another 15 minutes or so. Yeah. Yeah. So question is, for the recording, any advice for people who are having their status taken away? Is there a reason to maybe seek asylum in another country? And so, you know, I think in the abstract, I would say, you know, yes, it could make sense to file even for asylum inside the United States. And in fact, that may be my first go-to recommendation for people who are here, wish to remain here, and don't wish to flee. Getting a consultation or speaking to a qualified immigration lawyer is really great to just understand the specifics and eligibility and that sort of thing. But as it relates to the people who are subject to the termination of their humanitarian parole program, and specifically facing a risk of expedited removal, this kind of fast deportation process around the normal procedures. The law currently says, and if it's followed, this is the way it would work, if a person expresses a fear of return to their country, or expresses an intent to apply for asylum, they can't be subject to the fast deportation process unless they're given what's called a credible fear interview. And a credible fear interview is just a screening interview. So the idea is an asylum officer should come and interview a person and figure out whether they have kind of like a realistic chance of getting asylum if they were given a full hearing. The standard is by design low because we don't want to screen people who might have a good claim out and deport them. Right? And so that means that anyone who's in this humanitarian parole program who is at risk of being subject to expedited removal, if they are encountered by immigration enforcement folks, saying, I'm afraid to go back to my country, I wish to apply for asylum, would be kind of the best advice I could give for them, assuming that that's true, right? And I think for many people it is true. And that would at least entitle them to that screening interview, which, if they clear that, could entitle them to a full hearing before an immigration judge, and that very much slows down this process, right, and prevents that rapid deportation. So that's like my top line sort of best advice. Depending on the circumstances, some people might be eligible to seek asylum or protection in another country. We have what's called a safe third country agreement with Canada. So what that means is if a person first arrives in the United States, they have to, in all probability, unless an exception applies, get that protection application denied first here before they can then ask for protection in Canada. If they short-circuit that process and go to Canada first, they could face problems under the Canadian system. Although, and this is really fascinating, Canada and lawyers in Canada have begun to think about whether this safe third country agreement is actually even proper with the United States, given the level of disregard that we seem to have for the law these days. And so there's some really great advocacy being done by Canadian lawyers to maybe push back on the application of that law. But my again, general top line advice would be don't go to Canada, not quite yet, because that could be dangerous. However, if a person had another option potentially, you know, counseling people on what those other options could be, certainly would be something that a qualified immigration lawyer should be able to do. Jana? Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. So I'll do them in reverse order if that's okay. So the status of DACA right now is that we've not seen any indication, at least that I'm aware of, that President Trump has made concrete steps to take away DACA. During the first Trump administration, he did. Jeff Sessions did the initial sort of announcement, I believe, and then the Secretary of Homeland Security went through the process of doing a wind down of DACA. That ended up getting challenged and going all the way to the Supreme Court in a case called Regents of California versus Secretary of Homeland Security. And in the Regents case, the Supreme Court held that the administration hadn't sufficiently considered reliance interests of the DACA community and therefore undid that sort of rescission of DACA and sent it back down. There's really no question, I think, that DACA can be rescinded. It's just a question of whether they're going to do it in the proper and lawful way. And that's maybe some good news here, because some of the things that we've seen from the administration is they kind of don't want to wait to do it through the normal process. They want it done very quickly. And that actually makes it vulnerable to legal attack. So if they don't wind it down in a sort of smart way, there could be new challenges to it. The other thing I'll say about sort of the existence of DACA right now is, separate from the administration terminating it, there are other efforts right now by 26 red states to sue and challenge the DACA program to try to wind it down. That case is currently at the Fourth Circuit. They've been able to win before district courts in Texas, and more recently at the Fifth Circuit, and then it went back down to the district court, and it's back up to the Fifth Circuit. And there is absolutely a risk that a court will eventually say that the DACA program is unlawful, which will have to then be resolved at the Supreme Court level. Not at all clear, of course, that the administration, who would be the normal player to defend the DACA program in a case that's brought to the Supreme Court, that they would actually defend the program. But the lawfulness of DACA could get addressed by the Supreme Court through that alternative pathway, separate and apart from the administration sort of winding it down. So as of right now, the status of DACA is that if you currently have DACA, you can continue to renew it. Okay, so that's the current status of DACA in this moment. If you have DACA, you can continue to renew it unless and until a court says it's unlawful and doesn't stay that decision, which is currently what's happened right now. They've said it's unlawful, but they're like, we're not going to wind it down until someone above us actually resolves that question. So then as to the other part, what are the resources available for folks who have DACA and are looking for legal advice? So first thing I'd say is if you do the QR code, No, we didn't post that. Email me, because we have a list of resources and legal service organizations, other lawyers that are sort of available to do some advising. We also do some in-house DACA advising through our clinic and can help with some of those. Obviously, the demand is really great, so I can't promise that we would take on every DACA case. But if we can't help, there may be places where we can plug someone in with DACA and get them some assistance. Yeah, Natasha. Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's a big question, and that's okay. No, absolutely. No, I mean, certain of these changes, should go through Congress. I'll give you a for instance, right? So the way processing of asylum works at the border right now is a system that was created in 1996 through a law called IRA-IRA. In 1996, Congress said, we want to have this low screening mechanism, this credible fear interview mechanism, to ensure that if someone comes to the southern U.S. border and says, I'm afraid, I want to apply for asylum, they're not going to be sent back to a country where they're going to be killed or tortured or persecuted, right? Unless there's basically very little chance that they could be successful. Right? So expedited removal was created with this credible fear interview, this very low threshold for screening, intentionally, by design, to say if anyone has like sort of even a chance that they might be able to get asylum, we should give them a full hearing before an immigration court before we deport them. Right? And that system worked for a real long time. As the number of people who've come to the southern border have increased significantly, both administrations, Democrat and Republican, have become increasingly unhappy with that low threshold standard. Historically, about 80% of the people who came to the southern border could clear that low threshold. Both the Biden administration, the first Trump administration, the second Trump administration, hasn't liked that and has taken steps to try to reduce the success rate at the border. The Trump administration did it through what was called an entry ban or a transit ban. Anyone who enters outside of a port of entry or passes through a third country and doesn't apply for asylum can't get that more generous, credible fear standard. They have to get a more onerous, what's called reasonable fear standard. I know they sound exactly the same, but they're different. And the reality is that maybe closer to like 40 to 50% can clear that higher standard, right? And so that was something that was pursued during the Trump administration. It was continued during the Biden administration, sadly. And now there's no asylum at the border at all, right? So that's where we're at. If a president doesn't like that standard, they have to, in my legal opinion, ask Congress to change it, because it's a congressional action and the administration can't just unilaterally disregard it, right? And I think that's true whether it's a Democrat or Republican, my legal view. Contrast that, however, with some programs like TPS. TPS, Congress has given the president extraordinary authority to designate and undesignate TPS countries. And the idea is, I think Congress thought that a responsible executive would make these good decisions, base it off of actual humanitarian concerns in the country, whether protection needs were required or not, and would make those legal judgments based upon the conditions on the ground. If the president doesn't do that, there's not a lot you can do about it unless the president really disregards the legal processes for taking it away. And that's a little bit of our saving grace, both during the Trump one administration, where a lot of litigation was successful against challenging TPS termination, keeping it alive long enough until the Biden administration could then renew all of them. Or even right now with the Venezuelan case, Secretary of Homeland Security Noem, as well as President Trump, have said a lot of anti-immigrant things in the course of taking away Venezuelan TPS, which is actually what has given litigators the ability to say this is a equal protection violation because you're saying really racist things when you're taking it away. So even though saying racist things is really bad, right? From my perspective, it's been helpful for challengers trying to challenge the end of TPS. And so anyways, the point just being that's a space in which there's significant discretion to the president. Asylum is a place in which the law is kind of being ignored right now. So some of these moves are lawful, right? I wouldn't be able to say, like, with a straight face that the president can't, for example, terminate parole. It's something that Congress has given him the ability to do. It's just those authorities are being used in a kind of reckless way, in a way that's motivated by animus rather than legitimate sort of legal determinations. And so some of these things are lawful, but immoral, and some of these things are unlawful, and it really kind of depends on the issue. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's my fear. That's my fear. You know, if they just used existing resources to go after the folks without status who could be deported, I suspect the numbers would remain kind of constant, right? But I think the larger strategy here is, as you note, right, to take away lawful status from as many people as possible, to funnel people into this expedited removal process, or just ignore process altogether through things like the Alien Enemies Act, to try to get those deportation numbers exceedingly high, and sort of taking away legal status is like the first step. That's the fear. I think that's the goal. I think the president wants to make good on a promise of mass deportation, and this is the step one of how you might do that if you were to do that. Yeah.
Because I can just imagine if the administration is telling you one thing but something's being challenged in the courts, basically getting someone out of the country is a lot easier.
Yeah.
And once they're there, it's a lot harder for them to get back in. So, if I'm an ICE worker, I'm just going to get them on the plane. And what's the repercussion for that if they're not actually waiting for true legal means that needs to do so?
Okay. So I want to make sure that I understand the question. Are you talking about the legal ramifications for someone who would wish to help members of the immigrant community?
No.
No? Okay.
Maybe that too.
Yeah.
More specifically, if I'm being told by the administration to do one thing, but something's being challenged in the court, who do I listen to? And what are the repercussions
for
choosing one or the other?
I see. Yeah. You know, I think it can be difficult, and access to legal counsel, if you're an immigrant in that situation where you're like, okay, there's one thing that's being said, and I'll try to make it concrete, and you can tell me if I've understood your question or not. But like, for instance, under the CHNV program, the humanitarian parole program that's being wound down, everyone who was in that program received notice through their USCIS portal telling them that your parole is being taken away, your work authorization is being taken away. Here's the effective date for those things. You must leave the United States, right? And that feels pretty ominous and pretty scary. But the reality is that people who are in the process of seeking other forms of protection, like asylum, for example, don't have to leave the United States, right? They don't have to leave the United States. If they do, they'll abandon their asylum claim, for instance. And so it does feel scary, but in that particular instance, as an immigration lawyer, I would be advising my clients who have pending applications, like an asylum application, you have the ability to stay here. You have the ability to wait for a decision on your asylum claim. And the regulation or the sort of regulatory announcement that is very much sort of suggesting that you must leave by this date is incorrect. But that's a difficult thing for a person to know and understand on their own. So it's kind of hard, it's a hard question to answer sort of in the abstract. In some instances, you do have to follow what is being ordered, and in some instances, you kind of don't. As a lawyer, I'm ethically required to advise people to follow the law. This may come at a real significant surprise to those who say I'm engaged in fraud and sort of circumventing the laws, but as lawyers, we have no choice. I can't advise someone to break the law. Now, what I can do is say, this is what the law says, and your options are to comply or not comply. If you comply, right, here are the sort of pros and cons, here are the risks and benefits. If you choose not to comply, right, here are the sort of penalties that you might be confronting, right? I can never tell you not to comply, but at the end of the day, it's your decision what you choose to do. And that's my role as a lawyer to kind of advise them. So that would be the way that I would sort of handle that situation. If it comes down to a situation where the law says to do something, you know, that I regard as sort of wrong or immoral, I can't tell them not to do it. But if there is a legal justification for not doing it, then of course I can give that advice. And so I would say for any non-lawyer, the best advice would be to try to get the person plugged in with a lawyer who can help navigate that, because it's a dicey space, right? As a person who wishes to help immigrants, if you are in a space where you're advising someone to do something, it could be the unauthorized practice of law, so don't do that, right? And then the second thing is you don't want to put yourself at risk of some of these criminal provisions related to harboring and that sort of thing. So it's another kind of risk. But just doing that sort of work in conjunction with a lawyer would be the way to handle it. Have I answered your question? Did I understand it correctly? Or?
Not totally.
Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. I mean, government officials have to follow these sorts of orders and injunctions and things, and a lot of it is in the details of understanding where it is in the process. And so it may be, for example, that the government is ordering ICE officials to do a particular thing, and they have to do that particular thing. If a court has told them not to, then has the court order been stayed, and these kinds of things. So it's very much like in the details kind of question, but happy to chat afterwards as well. Other questions? Oh, actually, we're out of time. Sorry. Thank you so much for the engagement. I appreciate your attention, and let me know if there's anything I can do in the future. And hope you have a good rest of your Sunday.